Blog Talk Radio. That was Vlasis, and this is Continue Mission, and I'm your host, James McCormick. Got a heck of a show lined up for you tonight. We're going to talk about international politics. We're going to talk about diplomacy and how we can utilize diplomacy to potentially change the face of a country's current dictatorship from a dictatorship to a democracy. So we've got a lot of great people that are going to be on the show tonight, and I'm really looking forward to it. So we're going to be talking to Omar Hassan, who was a member of the Djiboutian, and I know that it's spelled with a D, so a lot of people see that, and they think that it says Djibouti, but it is actually Djibouti, if you read it. Now, this is a country... And it's a rather small country, but it's at the Horn of Africa, and it has a key port location. It's very strategic that the Chinese are very interested in. As a matter of fact, they've already got a naval base there. And, you know, whenever you've seen this happen, some of you that have watched, you know, how the Chinese have moved into these African nations, they treat the people horrible. They extract all the resources they can get, and then they jack up the debt, and when you can't pay them, they take property. Now, my good friend Rich Kilblaine says that it is a long-term plan, and I believe that. Rich, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
All right. So I'm actually traveling right now, so we're... So, you know, we can take Continue Mission on the road, and literally, I'm on the road right now. So, so I'm real excited about the show tonight, and I want to let you guys know I'm heading to Florida. So I'm going to Florida right outside of Orlando, and I'm going to be visiting my friend Ernie Rivera. We had him on the show talking about the service dogs. I'm actually going to pick up a service dog myself. And the service dog is going to become my companion. It's going to work with me in the field when I do my digging history. You know, it's a lot of times I'm out in the woods way back in the middle of nowhere and by myself. So, Rich, as you very well know, you've been on a couple of these adventures with me that sometimes
so
put
you're
us
gonna,
in the...
You're going to train that. They train that dog to smell lead bullets. Or coins.
Well, I wish that we could train it to smell, to sniff out gold coins because, you know, that's my bucket list thing there. You know, I haven't found any gold coins.
Yeah, you found plenty of silver. Yeah. You found plenty of silver. You just need the coins. They're gold coins, right?
Yeah, the gold coins, yeah. And you know, I know they're out there. We just got to find them. But the cool thing is that, you know, you as a historian, you understand this. Sometimes the most valuable thing that you find is not gold or silver, but that artifact, like that button that we found at Scary Creek.
Right.
That was a cool find, you know.
That you can almost nail it down to an individual, put a name to it. That brings an individual item to life. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that is really cool. So just to let everybody know, we found a half of a Virginia State Seal button. And we didn't realize what it was, but as we started to look at it, cleaned it up, and really got a closer examination, we realized what we had was not just any Virginia State Seal button, but it was a large Virginia State Seal button that also happened to have the edging around it, which made it an officer's button. So there were two officers. One was killed, which was a gentleman by the name of Lieutenant Welch, and the other one was Captain Patton, and that was George Patton's grandfather, who was wounded, horrifically wounded there. And, you know, as I studied that thing, there was a church up on that hill where you know, right, where we were at, right, where all those kids were at. And I think that was probably the church that they treated the wounded in. I just,
but that,
you know,
was also where we,
something
that
just
we believe they placed the artillery, right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as a commander
you found
of a battle, yeah, I was going to say, as a commander of a battle, that's where I would want to be, you know, on the highest piece of ground looking down at the enemy.
Yeah.
So in that respect, you know, it could have been either Patton's button or Welch's button.
You know, I went back there, Rich, and I searched in that area, and I dropped down over a hill, into the side of the hill, and I found probably a dozen infield bullets that,
wow,
you know, they were a smooth, yeah, it was, those
they
were pretty good
fired
signs. There was just a lot of crack.
They had been fired.
They had been fired.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
So those,
so those
the
were,
unit, so
those
the
were
Ohio
fired
troops,
by the unit.
Yeah, so those would, the Ohio troops would have been armed with infields then. Because I know the Confederates got a lot of infields. Because England was really sponsoring the Confederates. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were kind of opportunists, man. They were making money. So, anyway,
hey.
So I don't want to I don't want to eat up too much time, but go ahead, Rich. You were going to say something.
Oh, well, I was just going to joke that we were doing the same thing for one. We were supplying both sides. So, you know, can't blame the Brits.
Yeah. So tell me about that. In World War One, is that what you said?
Yeah. No. You know, the thing is, we were for free trade. And the reason we're supplying the Germans as well as the French and the Brits. But when the Germans started to send submarines after our transports, we got upset because it's like, basically they're saying you can trade with us, but you can't trade with England and France. And we're like, you're cutting into our profits here. Okay. So we're going to declare war against you. And when they sank the Lusitania, that was it. That was our excuse to declare war. But you know, we did, you know, you think of it as we didn't want to get involved in European affairs and stuff like that, but there is there's always a business interest behind it all. I mean, you know, when Bush said we're not going to war for oil, damn right, we wouldn't be involved in the Middle East if it wasn't oil there. Okay, so yeah, there is always an economic reason why we do what we do, why we don't do what we do, right?
You know that, and you know that was. So when I was in Desert Storm, you know, many years ago, God, you know, 30 years ago now, we got a chance to visit Aramco, you know, the Arab and American oil company. And,
right.
and we went in and we watched a video on how all this started, you know. Saudi Arabia was nothing before the oil came in. I mean, it was, you know, vast
correct
desert land, and
correct,
yeah, there wasn't a whole lot there, but when they discovered oil and they built this company called Aramco, you know, as you watch that, you started to see an increase, you know, in more than just the normal nation. You know, the British Empire had, you know, interest there long before all of that, but
the British and the French drew up the boundaries. They divided up the Middle East.
Right.
Yeah. And we didn't really care. We didn't get interested in it until Iran and the hostage situation. And I can the reason
right
I say that is because that's when I got my commission. But when I became a war planner, I was a planner for the Caribbean through U.S. Atlantic Command. And the Central Command cell was just getting heated. Or I say heated. It was like the 80s Latin America and the Caribbean was the hot spot. So the cell I fell into, the planning cell, was Southcom, Lantcom. We were busy. In fact, we were so busy,
right.
Usually it was one major, one captain. We had three captains. And instead of the major being the senior planner, he was the manager. It was the captain doing all the work. The major was just managing their workload. But in the other cell, it was as a major and a captain. You know, the captain was the assistant. But as we got to the end of the 80s, our interest in the Middle East was significantly growing. And a lot of strategic things we did, like pre-positioning packages, these are like deployment packages and stuff, in Diego Garcia, which is off the coast of India. We acquired 8 fast sea lift ships that could travel like 3 times as fast as most commercial ships, okay, so we could get there quicker. And that's why, it's because of all that, is why we were able to move 2 entire corps, which is, I think, 7 divisions, into Saudi Arabia in 5 months. In 5 months. It took 3 years to build that same kind of combat power in Vietnam. But we were able to do it in 5 months. Okay. So.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
It all changed. The oil and then the Iran hostage. And with that, we got in there. We were more interested in the problem with Iran. And then it just grew to where we are today.
So, which brings us to another section of the world known as Africa. You know, we're going to be talking about the Horn of Africa. I'm really interested in getting Omar on here and getting that going. But I know you've done some research, and I know Father Michael has done some research and some reading. So where is Djibouti, and why is it important?
Well, you described the Horn of Africa, but in particular, it's there is this narrow strait that's only about 17 miles long. If you look at, from the Suez Canal, the Red Sea, and right where it's basically where that seam narrows between Yemen and Djibouti, that's a choke point. And so it is of strategic importance for, basically you could shut down the flow of cargo by controlling either the Suez Canal or that strait right there. And like, for example, in the Persian Gulf, it's the Strait of Hormuz, okay, and that you keep hearing about that, and that's where Iran keeps, that's where it's been targeting other ships. Well, and as you correctly mentioned, China has gone in there, has built a huge Navy base. The United States has been there for almost 2 decades. Japan, France, now keep in mind Djibouti used to be a French colony, but so France is there, and I think Italy has troops there too. So you have a lot of allies, and they're all on one base, and then you have China over on the other, and everybody is looking, at controlling that, and that will have some significant geopolitics on what's going on, as far as the stability of Djibouti. Okay, we really need to have Omar come in and explain. When you look at Africa, you look at any country in there, the boundaries don't always – the boundaries seem to have been arbitrarily drawn by the colonial powers, okay? In fact, they did that a lot of times. You would have like a majority – everything's tribal. I think the only thing we have in our culture that is tribal is the Marine Corps. You know, once a Marine, always a Marine. Ask any Marine. I mean, they are loyal to the Corps. The Corps before anything, right? That's tribalism, okay? You have like the 82nd or the Rangers. No, that's temporary. Because as soon as you get another, actually, the joke is, the best unit you ever served in is the one you just left because you hate the one you're in. But the Marine Corps, they're tribal. And so when you look at a lot of these countries, Afghanistan, you look at Africa, and Omar is going to talk about that. You have tribes. And then within these tribes, you have clans and you have sub-clans. And the loyalty is to that. And that takes priority pretty much over everything. And so what you find is usually it's a tribe, a clan, sub-clan, or even a single family rules over everybody else. And so there may be like one large clan, but it's been split up between so many other countries that it becomes a minority in all the – where it could have been a majority – it is now divided up to it's a minority in the countries that it lives. And so the tribes that would have, or the clans that would have been the minority now become the majority. And because they were probably more secular, they were the colonial European countries gave that family, that clan, ruling authority, they were the educated, and so they tend to, persecute everybody else. Now, I will state this, okay, if you go on the internet and just start typing in, what were we talking about? Not Ethiopia, Djibouti. You start typing in Djibouti.
Yeah, Djibouti, yeah.
And they're going to find out, it looks like other than the Chinese being there, everything's okay. Yes, it's the longest, one of the longest serving dictatorships. The current president of Djibouti has been in power since 1999, okay? And when you read, like you go on Wikipedia or anything else, it says like it's stable. That's as far as our country looks at, we're looking at stability. As long we don't care, I'm telling you, look what Biden just did to Afghanistan. He doesn't care about the women.
Right.
He has empathy for them, but screw you when it comes to we ain't going to shed any American blood for it. Okay, you're on your own, all right? And the 200 Americans that are left behind, we're going to try to get you out. And all those allies that didn't get your visas passed, I'm like, I'm sorry. I feel for you, but, you're fucked, okay? That's the current foreign policy. If you listen to his speech, he wants to sound like he has empathy, but the reality is... he is not into regime change wars. Okay. So it's interesting because, we have a dictatorship, but we have stability. But the problem is with dictatorships, especially because you have a small ruling family, you can't voice your opposition. James, seriously, some of the things you were saying while Trump was the president would get you thrown in jail. And torture, okay?
Maybe kill.
And they might get
Maybe
it. Kill. They might, I'd be laughing about it, okay?
What's that? You'd be laughing.
Yeah, but I'd be willing to bust you out, okay? Yeah, I'd be willing to bust you out. But I'd be laughing about it. You brought it on yourself, man. Come on. I told you not to say that. Now, who do I have to shoot to get you out?
Yeah, well,
okay.
Four more years, we might have been back. That might have been the serious consequence, literally, you saw the, I literally received death threats, you know, from people because, you know, we used our official
again,
positions
that's how
to congratulate the president.
You're right. You know what? You know what? We are almost that bad now. Look at it. The goal of the Democratic Party is to put Trump in jail. Think about that.
They
will not stop. They are still looking. They're subpoenaing anybody they can. They want to put him in jail. Okay. Now, keep in mind, fair is fair. What did he say when he was running for office? He's going to put Hillary in jail and then you can't lock her up. What? This is like a third world country, okay? But we're getting there. We're heading there. We are so divided. Yeah, in fact, if you want to look at, like, what tribalism there, start looking at the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and I think you're going to get close to tribalism.
I would agree with you. That's the reason why, Rich, I'm not associated with either one of them. You know, if you go look up James McCormick, he is a registered independent.
James, you were identifying with a lot of the Democratic policies for a while. You were an independent in the beginning, but when Trump was in office, you really started hating the Republicans.
Well, what I hate,
that's why they were coming out and making death threats against you.
Well, the thing that I hated is that, you know, they espoused liberty and freedom, but they wanted to shut it down for anybody that wanted to say anything contrary. So, you know, I take on the underdog's position. I mean, that's when, especially on this radio show, I find myself, you know, it's like I've hated bullies my whole life, and any chance I get, I kick the shit out of them. You know what I mean? And you were that way, too. You hate bullies. I hate bullies. And it's like, you know, I saw this bully mentality of mainly ignorant people, and believe me, it's on both sides, you know, trying to bully their agenda on people. And, you know, and I speak out harsh. Here's what I speak out about. Who's taking care of the children? Who's making sure that we're having a good education? Who's really taking care of the poor, the widows, the orphans? The churches, for the most part, are not doing that now, you know, which they should be doing
that. Well, I'll disagree. I know the Catholic Church does. The Catholic Church, you know, I attend both Pachella's, church, you know, Charismatic Episcopalian Church, but my wife is Catholic, so I go to that one too.
Yeah.
And they have, like, people are bringing in sacks and boxes of groceries.
Yeah,
I mean,
they got a room
that's just packed.
Mm-hmm. Rich, I get you, man. And I see these blessing boxes all over the country. But, you know, a blessing box doesn't turn on the electricity. A blessing box, you know, doesn't pay a person's medical bills. You know what I mean? And the cost of health care.
Oh, you want to know what church will take care of that? Wait, you want to know what church will take care of that? The Mormons.
No, what?
The Mormons. Man,
well,
if
God
you're
bless,
a Mormon,
you
they're
know,
going
God
to take care of
that.
They're going to find you a job. Seriously. I've never – the Mormons is built around – they're Masons.
They
Mormon church is built around
form.
The Masonic Lodge. They take care of each other really well, okay?
So just to
anyway,
let you know,
hey, I think that's a good segue. That's a good segue Omar in, because Omar, that's what he's been advocating for. You're talking about a guy. We should let him explain it. But there are the two major parties, two major subclans or tribes in Somalia, Djibouti is the Somalis, the Afars, and then you have the Arabs and a bunch of other collections there. And he is Arab and Afar. So he's really on the outside. So the Somalis and their subclan, they pretty much control everything. And see, I've been, in talking with him, I'm like, man, I've seen this too many times because I work in these, most of my experience in Latin America. But I understand it. And what you found is the officers. Yeah, I should set this up because in talking with him, and this
will help validate
what he's going to describe, that the minority officers, they were the best, that they had to work real hard to get at. They were the majority officers, and especially the ones that were related to the ruling family, whatever, they were lazy. They didn't have to do anything to get ahead. They were going to get promoted regardless. In fact, when I went through the SF course, we had two. I love sponsoring foreign nationals. Okay, and I can't remember how many we had, but there was two Philippine officers, and I signed up to sponsor one of them. And luckily for me, I didn't know. After I worked with him, I got to understand it. Okay, there's the Tagalogs, which is the minority tribe. Okay, and then there's all these other little tribes. Well, the guy I got was the minority tribe. He was good. I was lucky to get him, whereas the other guy, he was lazy. So his sponsor was not having as fun as I was. And I was always grateful for that experience to work with him. So, you know, when I hear like, okay, so you're the minority guy, yeah, it makes sense you're taking care of everybody, right, because you're working, you know, you identify with that. And there was a lot of questions I was asking him, and I had to ask him, like, what sub-tribe, you know, what sub-clan were you? And I'm like, okay, so you're in the minority, you're the outcast. You have to work hard. You have to. I mean, you have to be good. And what I also found is with the minorities, they really tend to take care of everybody else better. And whereas if you're in the ruling family, you're just interested in money. You don't care about the soldiers underneath you. That is a common pattern I found. So I guess with no further ado, we should bring on Captain Omar Ali Hassan.
Hello, Omar.
Hello, good evening.
Unmute yourself.
How are you? Yes, I hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. James, you going to ask him questions? You want me to answer this one?
Yeah, no, I'm going to. Hey, Omar, it's good. It's good to have you on the radio show. Welcome to Continue Mission. You know, Omar and I have developed, you know, I would call it a very good friendship, and as I've got to know Omar, we've had, you know, plenty of Zoom calls and discussions, and what I have found is he is part of a larger organization or a large group that is looking to create a level of democracy that actually wants to work with the United States, wants to actually, you know, create an opportunity for us, you know, to collaborate, work together, whatever you want to call it. And I just think that it's a great opportunity, you know, to get to know him better. And the other thing is, you know, he participated in, actively fought in the war against terrorism. So, you know, he was out fighting against Al-Shabaab, one of the major terror groups in Africa, and he led the special forces unit that was there, and I just think it's really, really awesome to have you on the show, Omar. And I'm going to let Rich Kilblain, because he definitely has the questions, and he's a special forces guy too, so I'd like to let Rich set this up, and let's hear your story. What do you think?
Well, if you ask me, let's let Omar start talking. Let's let him introduce himself, what his background is, and let's get to that point of like why he resigned his commission and what he's advocating for. All right, and that's going to eat up a lot of time, and then Father Michael and I can come in and ask him questions. So, I guess you got an hour. All right.
I can barely hear you, but maybe Rich, James should mute, I think. Can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we hear you loud.
I can hear you.
All right. So I'm going to introduce myself. Thank you, guys, for hosting me. And it's a pleasure and honor for me to share my story and the story of my country. And as you explained it really well, this is the small country which is really strategic and hosting, you know, the unique military U.S. base overseas. Yeah, my name is Omar Ali Hassan. I was born on April 30th, 1978 in Djibouti. I'm a father of four minor kids, three boys and one girl. They are now married and they all reside now in Djibouti. So I'm a former commander of the Rapid Intervention Battalion. My rank is captain. I served 20 years in the Djibouti Army. I obtained my high school diploma in Djibouti in 1999 and studied science for 2 years at the French University in Montpellier, which is south of France. So I speak French, English a little bit, Arabic, German, Somali, and Afar. In 2001, I joined the Djiboutian Army, and in 2003, I became an instructor at the Djiboutian Military School. So in 2004, I was sent to the German to Germany to the Mountain Infantry Basic Officer Leader Course. 2008, I graduated then from Germany as a Mountain Infantry Officer and returned to serve in Djibouti, where I became company commander by the Rapid Action Regiment. From 2010 to 2011, I was sent to the Maneuver Captain Career Course and graduated from the Maneuver Center of Excellence in Fort Benning, Georgia, USA. So just right after, from 2012 and 2014, as James said, I was deployed for the African mission in Somalia as a company commander with the first ever Djiboutian sent battalion in Somalia. After my 2 years of deployment fighting the terrorist group Al-Shabaab, four of my soldiers were killed in action, and my company has seized from the terrorist group after a 24-hour attack, one of the most important cities in Somalia's central region. So, yeah, this is a little bit about me, and I had a lot of course, like, you know, the command and staff course by the Humanitarian and Peace Support School in Kenya. And I had also a lot of training with the Special Operation Command of Africa in Germany and a lot of seminar with the commanders, Special Force commanders. So, yeah. In August 2017, I was designated to gather, select, form, and command the Rapid Intervention Battalion.
Let me ask you something, Omar. Let me interject something. In our conversation and what I know about your background. Okay. You seem to have been the guy. All right. And this is a common pattern I find in a lot of these developing nations, especially where there's this tribalism. You get things done. And when you talk about the rapid deployment battalion, you get things done. You're the guy that is always second in command. You're the person that they put the family member or the guy has the, you know, connections in charge, but you're the guy underneath him because you get it done. But the other person is going to get the accolades for it. Does that sound correct?
This is correct. And before I
tell them about your last assignment.
Yeah. So when I came back from the Special Operation Command of Africa seminar, for example, it was in 2015-16, I organized and directed a six-month training for 450 recruits in the military school. I was the deputy commander, and I was in charge of everything. So the commander was sent into retirement, so I was the guy who has to take the command. But guess what? I was designated to gather, select, form, and command a new battalion from nothing, which is the Rapid Intervention Battalion. And after a hard work of 2 years, I was just taken from command without nothing. And there is a lot of reason of that. It's because...
Right, right. But I want to hear, tell the audience about what you did to get that battalion organized and how that started making a lot of other commanders jealous, envious, or not envious,
so,
jealous.
Yeah, so you have to know that every battalion has his own budget, and I used my budget into these 2 years to build the camp and also to feed really well my soldiers. But what the other battalion commanders are doing, they use only 30 to 30, 40% of the budget to feed their soldiers and to maintain the camp. They barely, you know, build something. So the 60 to 70% they use for themselves and for the high command. So within these 2 years, the things that I have achieved with my soldiers means that I have used their budget in the right place for the right things. It has put in, like, questions all the other battalion commanders and has put the pressure on them, so, and on the high command. So that's why...
Well, when you said that, the pressure was coming from the soldiers that served under. The soldiers that were in those other units were looking at your unit going, wait...
Yes.
The most important thing you are doing is not just building barracks, but feeding them, right?
Yes.
You're feeding your soldiers well. You're making sure they're getting taken care of. And all the other soldiers in the other units were actually noticing that.
That's why most of them were willing to come in my units, and they were starting to refuse orders to the other battalion commanders. You should know that I was taken after 2 years of my command. While last week we had four pass of command of commanders who were in charge 14 years. So these commanders have built it, and I have the proof for that. They have built houses for the general chief of staff as a gift to be maintained in position. This is what I refuse to do. And in order to take the budget out of me, the General Chief of Staff has asked the American, which was sponsoring my battalion to train and equip, has asked the General Waldhauser, which was the U.S. AFRICOM commander by that time, to take in charge the food of my soldiers. But General Waldhauser said, politely responded with a letter to our general saying that Djibouti is an independent country, and the partnership is training and equipping, but not feeding. So that's why I had problem with my general, and that's why I was taken from command. But there is also other reasons for that.
Well, I'm going to give a personal story that I find kind of comical. Explain some of the corruption. And if you work in an advisor in most countries, there's corruption everywhere. I'm friends with a retired colonel of Greek descent who spent a lot of time in Greece, and he would in even Greece. Okay. But we went down to do a mission a training mission. When I was I was both Special Forces, went down there, but I also I was offered chance to command a rifle company and infantry company and 7th Infantry Division. So I jumped at it. SF wasn't a branch. So when I got there, I did branch SF. But mutually anyway, because I was getting out. So my infantry battalion was going down to Honduras to train. We were light infantry. And they came up with the idea that, hey, because we're carrying so much equipment, especially water, let's get pack mules. And so we had a budget for $10,000. We get down there, no mules. So one day I'm talking to the major, who is a foreign area officer, FAIL, all right? And, I mean, this guy's job is supposed to know the culture of the culture. Now, keep in mind, I've already done out to Honduras while I was in on a team in Special Forces. So I already know this culture. And I go, hey, whatever happened to these pack mules we were supposed to get? He said, it turned out they were too expensive. It's too expensive. Honduras is one of the poorest countries in it. $10,000? I can not rent the mules. I can buy the mules, buy the mule skinners, and their daughters and thrown in on top of it. What do you mean it's too expensive? And he goes, well, we went to the Estado Mayor. They're thinking like the American Army. You go to the top and work your way down. I said, that's where you screwed up. Because everyone from the top down is taking their cut. So when you guys, when you think about, you look at the budget that we are, you know, that we give all the countries, not going to the people we need. So we're going to give this aid. That doesn't go to the aid. That's buying off the leadership. And he said by the time everybody had taken their cut out of it, there was nothing left. And I said, that's not how you work in this country. You go to the colonel in charge of this region, this province, and you tell him, hey, I need 200 pack mules. How much is it going to cost? And he says, I'll take this much money. And you don't go to this. There's too many empty pockets up there. You go to one empty pocket, there's a colonel in charge of the area, you pay him off, and you get what you need, okay? And then I bumped into an SF captain or major. I think he was a major down there. And they told him, he goes, oh, shit, you should have asked us, because we're working with those. He said, if you had asked us, we would have given them to you. And that's an idea of the corruption, is that everybody is wanting that money, okay? And as you described, so what it is the commanders are getting a lot of that, but they're kicking, they're doing, it's like the mafia. You got to kick money upstairs.
Exactly.
So they don't turn you in. So they're covering your back. And so the soldier's not getting fed.
Yeah. But in Djibouti, the corruption became toxic and, it is really alarming, and I think it is time for our partners to take the right decision and to try to help us, you know, because as you said, if I give you an example, a Djiboutian soldier salary is $300 when Djibouti is the most costliest country. One of the most costliest country in the world. So, and we have like all these bases who are paying, you know, this huge money. But, and we are less than 1 million people. So I will give you some numbers. So almost 20% of the GDP come from the bases rent. So the United States Camp Le Monnier, which is the name of the American camp, who's holding 4,000 men, they pay $63 million. So you have the French military base, they pay $40 million. You have the Japanese, the Italian, and the Spanish, and the German. So, and you have China since 2017. So we don't know exactly.
Wait. That is a bone I got to pick. So you said we're paying $63 billion a year. We're the biggest player.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we get a small enclave on next to the airport, right?
Yes.
China gets a port. They built a naval base with access to the water. And how much are they paying a year?
We don't know how much they pay, but
20. I read it. 20 million. They're paying 20 million a year for more property and access to the. We get access to the airport, but it's small. We're being gouged. China is getting bigger access to that country than the United States. Now, I would ask why. It's a rhetorical question. I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because we can pay $63,000. Our country is like we're being gouged by the ruling family. What I'm wondering is why China was able to negotiate this down to $20 million.
Okay.
They are good. Okay, you want to know, when they say China is our biggest economic rival, that's right, because we go in and the country asks for $63 million. We don't question it. We give them $63. China goes in there and work that deal down to one-third of what we're paying. Anyway, keep going.
Okay.
And the thing, I didn't know that was the biggest part of your GDP is all these military bases there because of its strategic location. But that money isn't going to the people, is it?
So this money is going to the one ruling family. You know, the one ruling sub-clan, the one ruling political party. So why 20 million for the Chinese military base and $63 million for the USA base? We don't know really how much they pay the Chinese, but what we know is that they have invested from 2013 to 2018, they have invested $14 billion in Djibouti in the different infrastructure.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. I think it's like 60 to 70% of the Djibouti
70% of the country's debt. Yes.
Debt belongs to China. And that's right. And what China has been doing is going in and loaning all these countries money. And as collateral, the country, that makes sense. The country has to put up property. And a lot of it is like your ports. Well, as you know, here's the thing. So the country, like we borrow this money for, look, our country is in debt. So right now we're about to go through a possible government shutdown. Because we have to raise the debt ceiling because we're spending more money than we're bringing in. So who's buying our debt? Well, we're selling bonds to anybody and everybody. Guess who buys most of our bonds? The Chinese, all right? They're buying up our debt, so we owe them all this money. Now, but we are transparent, all right? So when we say we got this $3.5 trillion package we're trying to prove, if you want to actually read that document and find out where it's going, if you got that much patience, you can do that. You can download that. But you can't in these other countries. And what happened is most of that money does not go to the people, does not go to project. It goes to the people in charge, which means they can't pay their debt. China ends up getting the property, and that's why they're only paying $20 million. They're paying $20 million where we're paying $63 million because the family. In fact, they did the same thing in Panama. All right. They own all the strategic sea lanes of communication. They own Panama, guys. They have the Panama. They have the contract for the lease for the Panama Canal right now. Right. So anyway, keep going. Tell me more. I'm just agreeing with you right now.
36.6% of Djibouti imports are delivered by China, and I already said that 70% of the country debts belong to China. If I talk about the president, the dictator, the self-proclaimed president, so as you said before, we have one ruling family, one ruling subclan, which is representing 5% of the country, and one ruling political party. In Djibouti, you have only one radio, one TV station, and even, you're going to laugh, but this is only possible in Djibouti, you have one dairy company producing milk, and it's owned by his son, and the other one is producing pasta, and is owned also by his son, and no one can import another kind of pasta or milk. So this is crazy. The leadership of the defense and security, the administration, the business, the diplomacy, 80% of the leadership of all these institutions or apparatus are held by this subclan, the so-called Mamasan, you know. So Gele is now 73 years old, and he has enjoyed 20 years of unchallenged power. So he has plenty of time to end the recurring violation of human rights and restore public freedoms. So if you see the 2020 World Press Freedom Index from 180 countries totally, we are ranked 176. So such a body is provided by the African Charter on Democracy, Election and Governance, signed and ratified by Djibouti, and would have ensured a transparent election and provided real candidates. But he chose a fifth electoral masquerade and a fifth illegitimate mandate. It was in April 2021. So unemployment, 50%, 5 to 34 years old, poverty, 41.1%. So this is crazy. You have like almost $170 million only from the basis. So I don't talk about 380 million people whose logistic is going through Djibouti. I'm talking about Ethiopia and a part of Somalia. So
right.
You know that the
I just
want to
make
Ethiopia,
a comparison just out of a joke. All right. So when you talk about poverty, 40% of your country lives in poverty. Okay.
Yeah, less than $2.
I remember a time where poverty line in America, I think, was below $14,000 a year. Okay. When I was waiting to get finished my – the reason I remember that is – I had finished my graduate degree, and I was doing odd jobs, waiting for a government history position to open up. And I was a manager of this one company, and I was making $14,000 a year. My wife was once in a while she would get a job, you know. 'Cause basically, I found in Oklahoma, average family income was about $30,000, because both parents were working. My wife wasn't. So we were actually below the poverty line. Poverty in America is different than poverty in other countries. Poverty in America means you probably don't own a car or something like that. But guess what? You have plumbing. That's an important thing. Describe poverty in your country.
That's a good segue, Rich, because that's what I would like to also speak to Omar about.
Yeah, Father Michael, go ahead.
Social injustices, the poor leadership that is obvious in the lack of sanitation and lack of education. I mean, the people have to see that when you provide good leadership, and we can go back to King Solomon, you know, the people prosper. And so can you speak a little more about that? We've said in our own lives. I grew up in a ghetto type of a situation, but when I went to Vietnam and stopped in the Philippine Islands, I saw poverty at a different level. I just think this is a reflection of bad leadership, poor leadership, when you can't provide these certain things. And they're indulging, as you said, in their own lives, you know, lining their pockets. And but speak to us a little more about sanitation especially.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. But I'm glad you brought that up, Father Michael, because I just wanted to say poverty in America is middle class in a lot of these other countries. So, Omar, go ahead and finish up. But describe poverty in your country.
Omar?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so I say, as I said, and this is all references. It's not something that I'm just, you know, creating. If you go on World Food Program, you will see that poverty has gone from 41% in 1996 to 79% in 2012. So people are living like less than $2 per day. Some people, they eat one meal per day. So imagine this small country of 23,000 kilometers square, which is, you know, like New Jersey. And you have all this income from the military base, but you have this income from the port, which is ensuring the logistics of Ethiopia. Ethiopia alone is 80 million people. So access to running water and electricity is inadequate. And the level of education is poor. So the health system cannot cope with malnutrition and diseases. So you have people in, we have two seasons in Djibouti, the fresh season and the hot season. So we said one season is the fresh season. You have a lot of malaria. People still dying, you know, a lot of people dying from malaria. You have also the diarrhea, so, and you have the chikungunya fever. So the Human Development Index published each year by the United Nations does not contradict the situation. Yeah. So the country was ranked 171 out of 189 in 2018. So,
you know,
people,
when I was writing my notes,
Djibouti,
Omar,
I
made some notes about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and I was wondering what your country's status is with the World Organization, and has there been any intervention or any sense of awareness of what's going on there?
So, no, the problem is, and what is really sad is that you have all these NATO forces who have their military permanent bases in Djibouti, and they don't act against you know, the president, the dictator, who prefers to govern through poverty and force. So and he has, you know, stronghold on the country's resources. So why he accepted in 2017 the Chinese is in order to counterbalance the policy of the NATO forces. So when he's not, you know, okay with the American, then he's going to go to the Chinese. So he's counterbalancing that, and that's why he's ruling, you know, over the country with force and poverty. But what they don't know is that the people, they have enough. They are in survival mode now, and this is source of instability. When you don't have fairness, accountability, constitution, a good constitution, and a transparency, this is fact. And, you know, by the way, James can hear me, we have put together all these, you know, words, and we say, hey, we should have a fact in a good democracy. You know, we have to have a fairness.
That's right.
Everywhere, it should be a fairness. And it should be an accountability. There is no accountability with all this money going to this small family. We don't have a constitution.
Well,
he has changed the constitution in 2010.
Okay. So being an American, a naive American, we would just say, well, why don't you protest government?
All right. So there were protests, and there were protests. People were, you know, shot with real ammunition, and people were killed. So last month, August 1st and 2nd, 15 people were killed in Djibouti because they were protesting peacefully. And 100 people were wounded, 15 were severely wounded. 200 houses were burned. So the government is just doing what they want. So you have the opposition party. They have won the election in 2013, the legislative. But because he's holding, you know, the defense, the security, and all these key positions by his family, he is using, you know, force. And most of the opposition party were forced to leave the country. So there is no other solution, you know. But that's why now we made a big coalition, and we have among this coalition one political party who is armed. You have no choice. And because of this armed political party, in 1992, a constitution were born in Djibouti, because before that there were no constitution. There were only one ruling party, but the dictator did not respected that and has corrupted, you know, the leaders of the opposition. And then who's suffering? Guess what? The Djiboutians. So Djibouti is a rich country, but Djiboutians are really poor.
Omar,
before we move
travels,
into the armed political,
let me just ask one quick question, because Omar is well traveled and has a lot of experience with even European countries, and I was just wondering, as we've talked about oppression, if he knows the story of Poland, and is there any hope in that regard?
In the regard of human rights?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, no, because in Djibouti, you have in 1991 a massacre, you know, where people, you know, the tribe that you talk about, one of the major tribes, the Afar, there were massacre in Djibouti, like 55 people were killed by the police and the army. And then it was another clan who were, you know, massacred. In 1990, yeah, 1 year before, it was the Gadabusi, which are from the Somalis, but not from the ruling clan. And then you have, in 2015, you have also another clan who were massacred. So there is no human rights in Djibouti. That's the problem. And there is, you know, ongoing violation. When I'm saying that there is only one radio and television, you can understand that human rights, it's just a strange world in Djibouti. And because of their interest, they are just, you know, doing like they are blind, you know. And this is really sad, because now the region is about to become unstable. And this is not good for the United States and all these countries who are present there, and for the Djiboutians. Because of one family, we're going to have a civil war in Djibouti. I don't think it's worth it.
Okay.
Do the people share a common faith, Omar? Do the people share a common faith, something intangible that's more than their clans? Is there anything that would motivate them beyond the external?
Yeah, no. What motivates the people is to be able to have, you know, a normal life, the minimum. So all the different groups of people who are living in Djibouti, they agreed that this government, this regime, should be ousted, with or without our partners.
But I think Father Michael is bringing up is they're all Muslims. The majority of your people are Muslims. So,
yeah.
So how does their faith, I mean, how do the corrupt families use their faith, you know, adjust or somehow justify in their faith that this is okay?
I mean, their faith is only the dollar, the money. These people are not religious. And
that's the reality. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
The ruling families,
not,
their religion is money. They may superficially, put on the pretense of religion, and that is common in our country. I want to put something into perspective. Like, for example, the Somali tribe is, I think, like 60% of your country. The Afars are 1%, and everybody else is lumped into that 10+%. Okay. So the thing is, they say a dictatorship. You call it a dictator. It's not. You have elections. You actually have elections. And your current president has been elected consistently since 1999. So how can that be a dictatorship? Well, let's look in terms of the polarization of our parties today. Let's say one party, Democrat or Republican, represented 60% of the population. And then the other party represented 30% of the population, and the independents represented like 11% of the population. Guess who's winning the election every time? And let's throw in a dynasty, a ruling family, like, well, the closest thing we've ever come to it in recent terms is the Bushes and the Clintons. They were really trying to establish, both of them were trying to establish a dynasty, ruling families. So that gives you a perspective. Think one party that gets 60% of the vote every time. Whoever runs for that party, which is the ruling family, is going to win. That's how you have a dictatorship. Omar, your turn.
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, I mean, the biggest problem is how the actual self-proclaimed president came. The president of Djibouti, Ismail Omar Gedi, has ruled the country since inheriting power from his uncle, so he didn't came with election. But after that, political parties of, the different Djiboutian civil society, they tried to do election with, this one ruling political party, but the repression, and the use of force made this, not happen. So that's
all right,
why.
All right, Let's use that as a segue to point out why you resigned your commission. Let's talk about that captain, pilot. Okay? You haven't mentioned him yet. Because I want to point out that Omar was actually attending the Army, the Command and General Staff School, when he resigned his commission from the Djibouti Army. Okay? Tell us about why.
Okay, so I arrived in Minnesota in April 25th, 2020, and after I left the DLI, which is the Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, so I succeeded to the English course, and I was about to go to Kansas for the Command and General Staff College. I posted my resignation to denounce the injustice, the corruption in my country, which became toxic, but also to save a young Djiboutian lieutenant, a pilot, not being killed. So I saw his spouse crying and begging the president of Djibouti to release him from prison. So this young pilot posted a video where he was explaining to the president and the Djiboutian that despite many mistreatments, reports addressed to the chief of staff, which is General Zakaria, he's 90 years old, and he has no answer that was given to him. So the pilot was complaining about his colonel, which is the Djiboutian Air Force commander. Once again, the Air Force commander, the Navy commander, the Republican Guard commander, the Coast commander, the International Relations commander, all the commanders are from the subclan of the president, so which is also a relative of the general. So the pilot was denouncing the abuse of authority, the racism and oppression he was victim. His colonel stopped his salary and banned him from flying for an ethnical reason, for tribalism. 37 years old, he's a father of 7 kids, and he's in prison since April 2020. So he has released a video posted on Facebook showing him with an infected skin and held in a toilet cell. So in a secretly filmed video, so it was on June 3rd, 2020, he said he feared he would not survive his incarceration. His lawyer says when he visited the pilot that he was showing signs of having been tortured. So I have the link of this video. This video was posted on the social media and it made the buzz. And then a lot of human rights tried to write about that. But yeah, the pilot's still now in prison. And in Djibouti, if you like on Facebook a post made by a person from the opposition political parties, and guess what happened? Then you will be put in prison. So seeing this horrible video in condition of detention, a lot of opposition manifested and they were repressed. So that's why I have posted my resignation, and also I had the right to bring my family here. So, but the higher command just refused it for free. You know, I had the right to take, you know, my family with me and my kids, which are minor kids here, because the course is more than 6 months. So the American, they allowed the IMS, which is the international military student, to bring their family if the course is more than 6 months. And you know, the staff college is more than 6 months.
Right, right. It's long.
So, yeah.
You've gone to the
because
long
of
course.
That,
sorry.
So
but I want to point this out.
Yeah.
That you resigned your commission 20 years, that you're losing everything. You don't need, do you even have a job right now?
I'm supported, you know, by a friend of my cousin that I, you
right,
know,
right. The point is, you resigned your commission. I mean, for people out there listening, you're going like, here, you hear the story about this pilot who's been incarcerated for expressing opposition to the party. And you're going like, I really resent that. Am I really willing to resist, give up my current job and my retirement, speak out against it? And that's what you did. You
yes.
resigned your commission so that you could speak out against this.
Yes, I mean, without sacrifice, some people have to sacrifice, and the best people who sacrifice first, this is us. I mean, this is the people who are in uniform. This is our job.
Oh, yeah,
the
and the thing
line.
Is,
you, know
you resigned your commission, and you didn't even have your family with you. Your family is still stuck
no.
in Djibouti.
Yeah, and guess what happened to them? So they are held in hostage indirectly by the government who is refusing to deliver them the passport since last year, 2020. So now I'm waiting my asylum being granted, but my family is threatened because since I became now one of, you know, the leaders, the figure of the opposition, because I'm also now the spokesperson of the biggest coalition, which is regrouping 5 political parties. One is one among them is an armed political party and civil society, youth association, and Djiboutian Right Association. So a lot of death threats. So last week, one blogger who is working for the regime posted, you know, a live video saying that my whole family should be blown up. So in Burma, in Djibouti.
Wait. That sounds like America. If you're a Democrat or Republican, that sounds like one of our parties saying, you know, burn the house down. shit, we're getting that bad.
Yeah.
Okay, but anyway, keep going, keep going.
But this is serious. This is serious,
I throw that out because for people who think like we're the best, we have the best political system. No, we're turning into a third world country. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Rich, can I just get a little clarification?
Please, go
Omar.
Ahead, Father Mike.
Yeah. Because Omar, you made the intimation that the present leader was a dictator because it was nepotism. It wasn't election. It went from the uncle to the nephew.
Right.
That's correct, to answer Rich's question.
Nepotism.
I know Rich's question was rhetorical, but I think it's important to bring that out because that's why we're dealing with so much oppression.
Yeah. This is right. It's nepotism, and now it's like fascism because clans and tribes are, targeted. And I told you last month, we have all the video. One of the biggest problem now of the regime is that they have shut down. They have lowered the speed of internet so people can barely follow us on Facebook. Imagine that. And people are using other VPN to go on Facebook because the last massacre that occurred last months were filmed. We have an undercover journalist. Yeah, you have to know that I'm the co-founder of the Independence Project, which is people have to visit independence.org. And the founder is a friend of my cousin. I was introduced to him, and we became, best friends, and he's my sponsor too, is Paul Taylor, And this is how I survived, and I got, for the nonprofit, was hired by him, but it was more a support. And this is how I can support my family, And Independence Project is about to do a partnership and sponsor now the coalition. And I hope we will have access, to the State of Department, the White House, and to give them awareness that this is really the time, to act. And last week, the dictator was evacuated to France. So he is in really bad shape. And there is no transition. We were prepared. So what we have done the last year with this coalition, we have prepared a transition, which is the CTD, a charter for a democratic transition, in order not to create chaos after, this dictator will be ousted by all, what we can use, to fight against him. So we use, the media to show, that people have to rise up, not to, give up, that we are, everywhere to support them. But we use, three front lines. So one of the front line is the media, and the diplomatic is the second one, and the third one is, the to respond, and self-defense is to take, the weapon. But this is not, the one that we choose the most. So that's why we want that the American leadership and, to collaborate with this coalition who is prepared, to take over and restore democracy and human rights in Djibouti. Yeah.
All right. Now we're going to get into the debate. Okay, you just laid the groundwork for it right there. Okay. Because before you kind of talked about our political party is like, well, for Americans who witnessed what happened on 6th January, that was not an armed insurrection. Those guys walked into there. They didn't have guns. Maybe a few did. That's not an armed insurrection. What Omar is talking about is an armed insurrection. So now let's start talking about the consequences. But before we do, I want to lay, Omar's I've watched some of the other videos. Look, I didn't do a lot of research because I didn't know exactly what we're going to talk to until today. And so whenever I look up Djibouti, it's kind of like, Yeah, you've got the, they don't really even talk about him being a dictator. But, yeah, he's been in power since 1999. But, hey, the guy's been doing great things for the country, if you read Wikipedia or any of the other articles. But based on what you're showing us, no. You know, poverty is no sewage, no running water. You're starving, okay? Political suppression isn't somebody, you know, criticizing you and lambasting you on the media. No, they're shooting you. They're putting you in prison. Okay, so now Djibouti is geopolitically strategically significant because whoever controls those straits controls sea lanes of traffic going through the Red Sea, the Suez Canal, Red Sea, and from the Mediterranean into the Indian Ocean. So that is why you have got China, the United States, France, Italy, Japan has military bases there. Okay. Now, do you think any one of those countries wants to disrupt the status quo? The answer is no. And for all you Trump haters out there, dictatorships provide stability. Dictatorships provide stability. As long as Djibouti is stable. Omar, I'm not saying that to defend you. I'm just throwing that out there for the Trump haters and the Trump supporters. So yeah. We're sitting there and you're describing these conditions. Now we're putting it on a human level. But for everybody else, you're going like, dictatorships provide stability. And I don't know any Somalis until we listen to you. We don't know any of these people. It doesn't mean anything to me. Look, Biden he just already wrote off the Afghan population. That guy just wrote them off. All right. There was a chance for democracy and women's rights, but he just wrote them off. He doesn't care. So why do you think he's going to, what do you think he cares about Djibouti? All he cares about is, all anyone cares about is traffic is flowing through the Suez Canal, the Red Sea, through those straits into the Indian Ocean. That's the reality.
Okay.
That's what, when you look at geopolitics. Now, convince the audience why it's important and what you want to see. I think you've already given up on diplomatic pressure. You're looking at armed insurrection. And this is where Father Michael's going to come in, because one of the classes he teaches, just and unjust wars, and that includes insurrection.
Right.
So Omar, convince us, what is the solution?
Okay, so this insurrection is not a new insurrection. This is what people should know. This is the insurrection who's continuing since 1992. The insurrection is called the FRUD. FRUD. So the FRUD forced the one ruling family in the 90s to put together a constitution who is allowing a multi-partyism. But after that, the government did not respect that. They have just corrupt the head of them, and the majority of the rebel went back to fight back in the north, which is most of them are afar. It's in the northern region. So how I can convince people? Because of what happened now, not at the Horn of Africa, but on East Africa. You know that Ethiopia is like in civil war now since 10 months, almost a civil war. And the President Joe Biden, you know, talked about sanction on whomever is creating instability and the humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia. You have to know why Djibouti will become unstable. It's simple. Djibouti, despite being an independent country since 44 years, depends on water supply, on electricity, on vegetables and fruits from Ethiopia. Instead of investing this money being independent for the Djiboutian, we still dependent from Ethiopia. So the war is going now in Ethiopia, and guess what's going to happen? When people will have no more water, and we have already a majority of the population who have, you know, no access to water and electricity. But imagine when the whole country will be without water, electricity, vegetables, what's going to happen? And the government is creating a war between the two major tribes, two major groups, the Somali and the Afar, who are also living in Ethiopia. So they are importing this instability in Djibouti. The dictator is saying, it's me or nothing. So this is why it is time now to get rid of this dictator and to collaborate with the political parties, not only ours, but there is other political parties also who are willing to restore democracy and human rights in Djibouti. This
all
is
right.
My answer to that.
Yeah, all right. Now me, as a former Special Forces guy,
I
love chaos.
The best interest of the,
Right, I love chaos. Okay. And I can play this both sides. I'm an old chaos guy. But I want to hear Father Michael talk about the ethics of just and unjust. You know, when he talks about just and unjust wars. Because, all right, there's a number of scenarios you can, as a historian, we look at, okay, so what you're talking about is war against one tribe versus another. I'm thinking of the worst-case scenario is the genocide of Rwanda, because it was one tribe against another. Well, no, actually, it wasn't tribe. They were all the same ethnicity. But what has happened is there was a elite, educated group of this tribe and the rural people. It's kind of like the Democrats versus the Republicans. Now, on the other hand, you have Liberia, Samuel Doe, I loved it. This is a story that was circulating when I went to the 7th Group as a captain. And it's like, so Samuel Doe is a master sergeant in the Liberian Army, and you have the same situation. A ruling dictator who doesn't care about anybody. Now, in Special Forces, you know, the story got embellished or whatever, but the way we heard it was, Master Sergeant Sam Doe was drunk, and he was bitching about how the president was, you know, mishandling the country. So he went over and shot the guy and killed him. And then he realized what he had done. He sobered up real quick, and there was a Special Forces team there. We send teams to Liberia regularly. Okay, so he goes to his team, the team sergeant, and he goes, well, look, I just shot the president. What do I do? Okay, and the guy goes, well, really, I can't advise you on this, but I can tell you, if I had taken over the government, this is the steps I would go through. So this team sergeant advises Sam Doe on how, now, after you've killed the president, what do you do? And you take over. And he ends up, you know, now, of course, he's going to persecute all the ruling family. The bottom line is, you know, a lot of these people are going to resist you to the end, so you got to kill them off. If you go to the Old Testament, this is where Father Michael is going to come in. If you read the book of Joshua, go to the Old Testament, you cannot allow anybody from the resistance to survive. You have to kill their children, okay? And Father Michael just had... He had Bible study, and he went over extensively the book of Joshua. All right. Mm-hmm. So the two of you go at it.
Let me first say that it's amazing with the starvation. When I was in Korea in 2000, I had read that in 1995, 2 million people had starved to death in Northern Korea. And it's like there's such oppression and the people almost passively, somewhat like what happened with the Jews in Germany. Now, in our country, and you might know some of the history, Omar, the passive resistance that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. advocated. And certainly there's not a total passivity, but nor is there a total war. We have to have justifiable reasons for entering and justifiable reasons for staying. I'm a Vietnam vet, and of course, there's a lot of controversy about that, and the country has never really reconciled the justification for it, and the way that it was dealt with caused a lot of turmoil in our country. So, you know, what is the proper way to bring about change? And I understand everything you're saying with
the
powerful family, the money, but you know, lives on the line, and you said it earlier, sacrifice is necessary. And it's not just for clean water and education, although you mentioned democracy, it's just for justice. There's so much injustice that's going on, but why would the people not resist even in a passive way and just, you know, starve to death and allow all these injustices? And I'm not even getting to the place yet where people are going to bear arms to try to defend themselves, because it has to be a legitimate authority, okay? And obviously this authority is illegitimate because you shared already about the nepotism. So it's really something that was taken, not something that was given. And I personally believe all authority is from God, and it's given. It's delegated authority. And so I'm just curious as to, are there other ways to persuade? And I know money's, you know, follow the green, I get you. But are there other ways? And in our country, there were great injustices to African Americans. And yet there was a way to prick the conscience of the whole culture, the whole society, not just the corrupt political leaders. And so, you know, and you're a tactician, you're an operator, you know more than I do. I was an Army chaplain. I was an enlisted in the Navy during the Vietnam War. But what is just? Because what happens sometimes is the oppressed become the oppressors. If the transition is not just, it's not righteous.
All right.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. Okay, this is a really good question, if it's not the most important of the show. Mm-hmm. You know, in our religion, in the Quran says that if you kill one person, it's like you have killed the whole humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you help a person to, you know, to come back in life, like a starving person, or you help someone or you save someone, it's like you save the whole humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing should be clear, I'm not a part of the fruit, which is the armed political party who is existing before, you know, at the beginning of Djibouti,
mm-hmm.
and who has brought, you know, this constitution. But the food is a part of the group, these different political parties who are, you know, peaceful political parties. And we all came together to put, during this last year, a democratical charter who will allow a transition with transparency, fair election, respect of human rights and everything. And we have published this charter, and we have said to the people of Djibouti that we are open to their feedback, and that we have put this charter in order to help the constitution who were violated in 2010 by the dictator who has changed the constitution in order to run unlimited presidency.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, it is like the last course of action. This political, this armed political party is existing since decades. We cannot change that. And they are doing self-defense. And this
and that's
most
right.
Of,
and that stands historically because the same principle you shared from Islam is in Judaism. And that's right.
Yeah.
It's the last course of action, you know, as far as one person. Yes. No, and absolutely.
So,
and self-defense, that's right. You have the right to defend your own life.
Yeah.
And that is something that's
so the
deep.
Operation,
mm-hmm.
The operation of the food is more in the northern part of Djibouti. But let me explain to you our coalition. The main effort, like we use, you know, this word in the military, the main effort axis is advocacy for human rights. We denounce through the social media. I run a podcast once a week here by the African Development Center in Minneapolis, showing the human rights violation and trying to awaken the people that they have certain rights. Problem is in Djibouti, people, they have no rights. They have zero rights. They don't have the right to have an opinion, but they don't have the right to leave because they are starving. So what we are doing is trying to contact now the right people like you guys. Through you guys, we're going to contact all these diplomatic institutions, the United Nations, the State of Department. So next week, we're going to send, you know, our charter, which were translated in English, and our memorandum to show them this is our project. This is what we want in order to keep stable this this part of this region who is already, you know, a region who is unstable with Somalia and now Ethiopia and Eritrea in the north. And you have from the other side, Yemen. So this is the work that we are doing, and we do everything not to create a civil war in Djibouti. But the Djiboutian regime, in order to divide the Djiboutians and to divert them, is creating amongst the two major tribes, the Somali and the Afar, a hatred by feeding the war in Ethiopia. So, and you have on the social media all these people who are hired by the regime and insulting the other tribes and creating this fabricated hatred between Djiboutians.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we are saying. We are saying, hey, please, now they have reached a level where Djiboutians will kill each other, and they will just take their private jet with all the money that they have gathered. It's 44 years. Imagine the dictator is the second richest African president, you know, in the continent. You cannot imagine, you know, the money that they have stolen from the country. So, no, we are not encouraging the transition by the weapon. We are, you know, using the media, the awareness, and we are taking contact. That's what we are doing now with the different actors of who are present in Djibouti and saying, hey, it's about to become like a Rwanda, and people have enough.
Yes. I think we would both agree this whole strategy of trying to divide the people is from the evil one. And, you know, trying to separate people. I want to bring us back again to Poland. Now, certainly the atrocities here are much greater, but the Polish people were greatly oppressed. And when Pope John Paul II became the Pope, who was from Poland, he was able to persuade not only the leaders there, but put pressure on from the country, just like you're trying to do, from the whole world, from the world community. But what really brought them together, you know, they had a transcendent desire for something greater than the government could provide. And they were being exploited, and it's interesting because, you know, one of the factory workers became president. And, you know, we think of Nelson Mandela as well. So I really hear, you know, what you're saying. And like I said, you may not be aware of that particular victory in that country, but I think your strategies are right. I think in my regard, they're biblical, they're principled, but somehow the people at the grassroots level have to be convinced of the justness of it. And obviously the control that's there and the injustice that's there, that's why I asked earlier about the United Nations, because there's got to be political pressure. You know, if you know anything about the Universal Declaration of Rights, every country, irrespective of their religion, their culture, they're expected to act civilly. And what you're saying to us tonight is they're not acting civilly, and the people are being greatly oppressed.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
All right. Give me a chance to interject. This is a great debate, guys. All right. Let me throw something out really short. Okay. One, we talked about the geopolitical or the importance of the location of Djibouti. All right. And China has a base there. If the UN, the UN isn't going to do anything. They're going to say stuff. They're not going to do anything. If the United States and its allies, which are already in there, start, the fact that the United States is paying three times as much as China is for its base might not get kicked out, all right? But the fact is that I'm going to tell you right now, Biden, based on his speech, is not into regime change. He's into stability. He's not going to risk American lives for anything. And the fact is that China's got a base there. We're probably concerned about getting kicked out of this country. So guess what? Omar and all his friends are on their own. Okay? That is a geopolitical reality of it. Okay? So now we get into
it. Go ahead, Rick.
Go ahead. No. Because I'm going to sit there and go on like, if you want to change, the only change is, look, these families, the rulings, I'm going to tell you right now, the only way you can, as a historian and as a special forces guy, the only way you're going to remove a ruling family is by a gun.
Yeah, well. And here's the situation. So we got like 10 minutes left, and what Omar hopes to do, and with the independence .org, and with with a group of veterans that are going to be engaging in this, is, you know, there is a level of diplomacy that can be applied, you know, to not force the change, but to encourage the change. And and the first thing we have to do, we have to educate the people of America that, you know, eventually, you know, Biden will not be in there forever. You know, you're going to get another president in there. And, you know, if we want this change without bloodshed, then there's a way to do it, but we have to do it responsibly. And we have to do it smartly. We have to get other nations involved. Now, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a darn good reason to get people to at least speak out. You know, right now, 90% of the American people don't even know where Djibouti is. Well, in 1957, you know, they didn't know where Vietnam was either, but they learned real quick where it was at within 10 years. And that's because, you know, we kind of allow this thing to fester, and instead of supporting, you know, a transition to democracy, you know, when we would not do that, then communism took over. So you got the Chinese that are already there, and if we want the Chinese to control the entry and the exit to the Red Sea, then we can do nothing. And so when I look at this, I look at this as an opportunity to actually prevent bloodshed in the future by letting this man have a platform and at least getting him to the Secretary of State and in front of the UN and to push the international human rights piece on this. I think that's the strongest message we can put out.
I agree with you, James. I agree with you 100%. That came to me first, and I like your emphasis on diplomacy and not bloodshed. And I think it's very important for us to kind of prick the conscience of the rest of the world that could let humanity suffer in that manner and not try to bring about some change by moral outrage, if anything.
Okay, it's my turn. I want to turn it over to Omar.
From James.
As an old SFA team commander, I love chaos. I didn't care who we fought. I just wanted to get into the action. The thing is, I don't believe ruling families are going to bend under pressure, and it's going to take the gun to make them bend under pressure. So with that said, what I fear is a Rwanda situation. So you have one clan or sub-clan finally gains power, do they do a genocide to eliminate the other clan? All right, while the two of you are advocating nonviolence, there are nonviolent solutions. But sometimes we come to a point where they're like the American Revolution. We are not subjects of the crown of England because we chose a violent solution to our problem. We chose to be independent of that. And so, as you know, Omar has been very diplomatic about it. And when I talk to him and I look at everything else and I watch other podcasts, I think he's evolved. Yeah. And I think he's evolved to the point where he realizes that diplomatic pressure is not going to work. That armed insurrection might be the only solution for that. Now, Americans, I can tell you right now, Biden's not going to support it. You know, or even if Trump, he wouldn't have supported it because we don't want to get expelled from Djibouti because that is a strategic location. So, for me, as an advocate, anybody listens, I like to play the devil's advocate. But as an SF guy, look, I don't care who fights. I just want to pick the winning side. And I want to make sure we do a good job at it. So if if insurrection has to be the solution, genocide is not the answer. Right. But in the short time we have left, I think James and I both want to hear. Omar, tell us how we can support you. First of all, support your cause, and then support you. You don't have a job. You're living on the gratitude of other people. So here's your opportunity.
So, okay. I will say yes on the gratitude, but I succeeded to put together something with my sponsor, and we have a project. So I'm the executive director of the Independence Project, which is independence.org. It's a nonprofit. So what James said, if I give you, how we made this Independence Project and independence.org, Djibouti is a beta project of the, Independence Project. But this is what we have done. We started to hire some undercover journalists in Djibouti just to send us videos and shows how Djiboutians are living in poverty, showing, you know, with videos, with images, with voices, how the infrastructure are, you know, inexistent and there is no sewage. So this, we made all these videos to show that the money that is coming in Djibouti is only taken by this family. So in order to bring awareness, we have made a lot of videos. But guess what happened to one of these journalists who were caught by the police? He was put in prison and he was tortured, and they have tortured him with electricity. And he was released after that, and then he had to leave the country. And he has sent me, you know, the pictures and the videos, you know, and have posted all of that. So we are doing a big work, showing first that the situation, the humanitarian and the human rights situation is, you know, in Djibouti violated, daily violated. And
all right, all right. Omar, we got like 3 minutes, less than 3 minutes. Got it. Is there some place?
So now,
do you need people to call their representatives? Do you need them to donate to a website? That's what I want to hear.
Yes.
You got less than three minutes to tell people what they actually, what Americans listening to this show need to do.
I think if every American is giving $1 for this cause, which is, you know, a noble cause, to, you know, help people who are oppressed, and especially to know where their taxes are going. USA is paying $63 million to Djibouti, but Djiboutian people are, you know, really poor. Is to donate and support the project, the independence project, and go on the website independence.org. They will find everything there about Djibouti with proofs.
Say it
so
again.
They can
it
donate and help us.
Where do they need to go again? Say it slowly.
Independence.org.
Okay.
Yeah. Independence.org.
Okay, we got a minute. Close it out.
Yeah. So then this is how they can help us and, you know, contact their representative and say that something is about to happen in Djibouti. And the best way is to help, you know, these people and this coalition who is doing a good job and trying to transition peacefully before things, you know, went to chaos in Djibouti. And it's a probable course of action. So this is how they can help us and, you know, help me through asking the representatives to help expedite my case and you know, bring my family here.
Omar, all right, we got 10 seconds. It's been great having you on the show. You have never asked for anything for yourself. You deserve a lot. Your concern is about your country. And for all our listeners, I hope there's something you can do for it, okay? So thank you all for listening and good
night. God bless you. In my prayers, Omar. Your people.
Hey, God bless you. Thank you. I'm grateful for you guys.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
All right. Good night, James.
Good night.